This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. A new report says the U.S. military was urgently warned about civilian presence before its deadly drone attack in the Afghan capital Kabul last month. Saudi Arabia carries out fresh airstrikes on Yemen, killing at least seven civilians in the southern province of Shabwa. Also, France accuses Australia and the U.S. of lying after Canberra canceled a multi-billion dollar order for French submarines in favor of American vessels. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, a report says the CIA had warned about civilian presence just before a U.S. military drone strike hit the Afghan capital last month. According to informed sources, the CIA's warning was heard 29 seconds before the missile struck its target, killing 10 civilians, including seven children. Families of the victims are now demanding a face-to-face apology and compensation for the lives of their loved ones. A top American general has already admitted that the August 29th attack did not kill any terrorists. The U.S. had earlier claimed that the missile fired from its drone hit a position of Daesh terrorists. Washington then said that the attack was in retaliation for bombing of the Kabul airport as foreign nationals were being evacuated. Saudi Arabia has carried out yet another deadly airstrike in Yemen, killing at least seven civilians in the country's south. The attack happened in the town of Marja in Shabwa province. The victims lost their lives after their car came under attack. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. Since then, hundreds of thousands have lost their lives and many more have been displaced. The years-long aggression has also targeted the country's infrastructure, leaving the Yemeni people in abject misery. The United Nations has called the situation in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Our correspondent Abdullatif Al-Washili joined us earlier from Yemen's capital Sana'a with more details on the latest Saudi aggression against the country.
Seven people were killed today, including a woman and three children, in a Saudi airstrike in east of Yemen in Shabwa province and exactly in Marja directorate. These people were on the ride heading to maybe one of their families, but they couldn't be due to the Saudi airstrike. They were killed, all of them, seven people. This is what Saudi Arabia has been doing in Yemen for the seventh year, killing women and the children. Tens of thousands, actually, of women and the children were killed during 7 years of a deadly war and the blockade. The people today in Yemen are suffering from a lot of aspects due to the Saudi-led war and blockade imposed on the country. We have a severe fuel crisis. We have a collapsed healthcare system. This is the result of the Saudi-led war and blockade. Yemenis today are seeking to be the victorious one. They want to force Saudi Arabia to stop its war and a blockade that it has imposed on the country 7 years ago.
President Ebrahim Raisi has hailed Iran's gaining full membership at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as a diplomatic success.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was a strategic move and a diplomatic success.
Raisi says the membership establishes a strong economic link leading to Iran's access to Asia's economic infrastructure and its sustainable resources. He made the remarks upon arrival in Tehran after his three-day visit to the Tajik capital. Raisi attended the 21st summit of the SCO in Dushanbe, where Iran's full membership in the organization was approved. The president also spoke of Iran's stance toward Afghanistan that was mentioned on the sidelines of the summit. During a press conference before leaving Dushanbe, Raisi stressed that Iran would not allow terrorist groups like Daesh to establish a presence near its border with Afghanistan.
The U.S.-trained Daesh terrorist group has moved into Afghanistan after committing atrocities in Syria and Iraq. The presence of Daesh in Afghanistan is dangerous, not only for Afghanistan, but also for the region. We will not allow terrorist organizations like Daesh to set up bases on our border and strike other countries in the region.
In the joint presser, presidents of Iran and Tajikistan called for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan following the Taliban's takeover of the country. Raisi noted that a government comprised of only one political or ethnic group cannot resolve the problems in Afghanistan. Imam Ali Rahman also said peace and stability should be restored in the war-stricken country for the sake of regional security. He warned that an escalation of violence could lead to a humanitarian disaster for Afghanistan and turn it into a hub for terrorism in the region. Iran has become the ninth member of the influential Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The decision was made during the SCO's 21st annual meeting in Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe. Tehran's message at the summit was embracing multilateralism to counter regional and global crises.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from eight member states and four observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday, with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. Xi criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterpart from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era but a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges.
The SCO organization now has three countries targeted by U.S. sanctions. Iran's admission was a natural consequence of Washington's aggressive maximum pressure campaign against these countries. All the three countries have stated that the days of U.S. unilateralism are over.
In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. Two key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit, SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress opposition to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights, or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
France accuses Australia and the U.S. of lying, lashing out at the U.K. for its call to permanent opportunism. This comes after Canberra ditched a deal to buy French submarines in favor of a trilateral military partnership with London and Washington.
There have been lies. There has been duplicity. There has been a major rupture of trust. There has been contempt. So it's not going well between us. Not at all. That means that there is a crisis. The fact that for the first time in the history of the relations between the United States and France, we're recalling our ambassador for consultations is a grave political act that shows the intensity of the crisis. We're recalling our ambassadors to see how we can reevaluate the situation. But with Britain, we do not need to. We know their constant opportunism, so there is no use in having our ambassador in Britain come to explain that to us.
Jean-Yves Le Drian said French President Emmanuel Macron had not spoken with his U.S. counterpart about the issue. Le Drian said NATO would have to take account of what has happened as it reconsiders strategy at a summit in Madrid next year. He said Paris would make a priority to develop a new EU security strategy when it takes on the bloc's presidency at the start of 2022. Earlier, France's envoy to Australia said Canberra made a huge mistake by scrapping the submarine deal with his country.
I think this has been a huge mistake, a very, very bad handling of a partnership, because it was not a contract, it was a partnership. A trust partnership that's supposed to be based on trust, mutual understanding, and also a partnership based, you know, on sincerity.
The French ambassador says there needs to be some reassessment of bilateral ties. He made the remarks before leaving Canberra. The envoy was recalled to Paris on Saturday along with the French ambassador to Washington. On Thursday, Canberra announced it would scrap its 2016 deal with France's naval group to build a fleet of conventional submarines instead, build at least 8 nuclear-powered ones with U.S. and British technology. Our correspondent in Paris, Kristen Ont, says Canberra's cancellation of the submarine deal was a huge blow to France, both economically and diplomatically.
It's a huge diplomatic crisis, and the words used by French Foreign Affairs Minister Le Drian are very strong. He speaks about reorganizing the NATO, the European defense, taking measures to take more distance with the US and the UK. At this moment, it's all strong words, not yet followed by acts. It shows that France is furious about the cancellation of this this contract. It must be said that the contract between Australia and France was about conventional submarines. Meanwhile, the new contract with the US and the UK is about nuclear submarines. So that might be an important difference in the production. It's also important to understand the French anger because the shipyard, which was in big crisis like 10, 15 years ago, was rebuilding with new contracts. And one of these contracts, important contracts, was just the building of submarines for Australia. Schools have been built there. Many work contracts will have to be cancelled. So it's a big blow for the French diplomacy, for the French economy. So there are some reasons to understand the reason why the French diplomacy and Macron also, the French government, the authorities are really very, very angry.
Once again, the Yellow Vest movement in France has protested against the mandatory health pass. The movement seems to weaken, and its organizers say they want to reconnect with the original purpose of the movement, social justice. Our correspondent has more.
In many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021, after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid and most of all, offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking. The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Well, that is it for this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
Despite its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the U.S. military maintains an over-the-horizon capability which allows it to continue launching airstrikes. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Edward Hunt Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Drones Still Fly Over Afghan Horizon. Stay tuned for the details of this article. facing unrelenting criticism over the 20-year-old U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, the American administration is insisting that the United States will maintain a capability to launch airstrikes in Afghanistan, regardless of the legal limitations and possibility of perpetuating the war. The Biden administration vows to keep in place an over-the-horizon capability, meaning that the United States will still be able to strike targets in Afghanistan from its military positions outside the country. This war has no legitimacy anymore. It's just a struggle for a balance of power, dispensation of power between various factions. No Afghan, especially civilian Afghans, should die because of that. There isn't a scrap of earth that we can reach out and touch when we need to, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin remarked in comments to the press last week. As part of the 20-year-old U.S. global so-called war on terror, the United States developed the capability to quickly launch airstrikes against many countries around the world. Officials say the U.S. military is currently exercising an over-the-horizon capability in several countries, including Libya, Yemen, Syria, and Somalia. We run effective counterterrorism operations around the world where we know terrorism is more of a threat than it is today in Afghanistan, without any permanent military presence on the ground, said President Biden in a speech last month, adding, we can and will do the same thing in Afghanistan with our over-the-horizon counterterrorism capability, unquote. Now that the Taliban has taken control of Afghanistan, it is unclear whether the U.S. can legally exercise an over-the-horizon capability in Afghanistan, and it's unlikely that the Taliban would permit the United States to launch airstrikes in the country, as the previous Afghan government had done. Upon entering office, President Biden placed limits on counterterrorism drone strikes outside of conventional war zones. With the war in Afghanistan ending, the same restrictions could apply to Afghanistan, leading administration officials to rethink their plans. For years, U.S. officials have justified airstrikes by citing the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, which permits the president to use military force against the perpetrators of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Some officials have grown increasingly critical of the resolution, especially over the manner in which U.S. presidents have used it as a dubious legal basis for the forever wars of the post-9/11 era. In a congressional hearing last month, some members of Congress called for the use of force authorization to be repealed and replaced. The authorization has been stretched beyond all recognition in terms of its scope and reach from what was contemplated when it was initially adopted, said U.S. Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, in the hearing. Periodically, the United States has set aside issues of legality to conduct airstrikes that have violated international law. A notable example is the cruise missile attack that the Clinton administration launched against targets in Sudan and Afghanistan in 1998. Critics warn that airstrikes can cause tremendous harm, especially to civilians. Whistleblower Daniel Hale, who leaked classified information about the U.S. drone wars to The Intercept and is now serving a nearly four-year prison sentence, has repeatedly warned about the risks to civilians. Hale reflected in a letter that he wrote about his decision to blow the whistle. When I finally left the military, still processing what I'd been a part of, I began to speak out, believing my participation in the drone program to have been deeply wrong. In the 20-year war in Afghanistan, thousands of civilians have been killed in airstrikes, with 700 killed in 2019 alone. Yet no high-level U.S. officials have even been held accountable for the role in directing attacks that have killed Afghan civilians. Amid the chaos of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the U.S. military exercised its over-the-horizon capability in a way that demonstrated the dangers of the approach. Following the terrorist attack at Kabul airport on August 26 that killed an estimated 200 people, the United States initiated drone strikes against targets without fully knowing who it was targeting. On August 29th, a U.S. drone strike killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. U.S. military leaders claimed to have targeted terrorists, with U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley calling it a righteous strike, but an investigation by the New York Times found no evidence to support these claims. The man targeted in the strike was Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S.-based aid group that provides food and assistance to poor Afghans. Ahmadi was seeking refuge through settlement in the United States for himself and his family. President Biden has said that it is time to end the forever war in Afghanistan, and after drone strike that killed Ahmadi, he insisted that the war in Afghanistan is now over. Some officials have quietly supported the president's decision despite the widespread criticism that he has faced from the U.S. foreign policy establishment. This war has no legitimacy anymore, U.S. Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad commented last month at the Aspen Security Forum. It's just a struggle for a balance of power, dispensation of power between various factions, and no Afghans, especially civilian Afghans, should die because of that. By maintaining an over-the-horizon capability, however, Biden is bowing to its pro-war critics and continuing one of the cruelest aspects of the war, the deadly air campaign, which has already devastated the lives of so many Afghans.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
communique.
It's been 20 years now since the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, which killed 3,000 Americans, saw the World Trade Centers collapse, the Pentagon on fire, and another plane lost. A violent tragedy, which was used as a pretext to start not just a war in Afghanistan, but an entire war on terror, spanning multiple continents, killing scores of innocents and displacing millions. Almost 20 years to the day, the United States has finally left Afghanistan. While the media fixates obsessively over the withdrawal, what about the war itself? If America started an entire war in order to fight terrorism, shouldn't we be asking whether it worked? Did the United States actually defeat terrorism, or did it make it worse? What could possibly justify occupying another country for 20 years, killing hundreds of thousands, and displacing millions more? This is what we should be asking. It's the only sensible, rational thing to do. But no one seems to be asking the question, so we will. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. It's been 20 years now since the attacks of September the 11th, a tragic event that left 3,000 Americans dead and the world in shock. What was at first an awful terrorist attack was soon to become the catalyst for war. U.S. President George Bush, along with his British counterpart Tony Blair, used the pretext of 9/11 to attack and invade Afghanistan, which they called the War on Terror. Now, of course, in 2021, they try to justify the invasion by saying, oh, it was good for women's rights, and we were nation-building, and oh, democracy. But back then, these terms weren't even heard of. The phrase nation-building or women's rights wasn't in the conversation in 2001. Back then, what they said was, we have to go to Afghanistan and get bin Laden, and get al-Qaeda, and get the Taliban, because they sheltered bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And to do this, the U.S. Congress passed something called the AUMF of 2001, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. Now, the AUMF doesn't even specifically mention Afghanistan, or al-Qaeda, or bin Laden, or the Taliban. The AUMF only refers to those who attacked America, or helped attack America, on 9/11. It's 1.5 pages long, and extremely vague. It talks about an abstract, undefined enemy whose name we don't know. We don't know where they live. They use these broad blanket terms on purpose. You know, just conveniently, it's an abstract enemy, an open-ended war that can't be finished, just like the war on drugs. And every single person in Congress voted for this, barely a week after 9/11, with the exception of Barbara Lee. And so after 9/11 happened, the Taliban actually offered to hand over bin Laden. They told the U.S., here, we'll give bin Laden to a third country if you can prove that he's guilty first, which is basic rule of law. It's a minimum requirement for an extradition. But the U.S. said no. They refused multiple times. So what does that tell you about their intentions? I mean, if you're going to go to war because you're so sure that it was bin Laden, then surely you can prove that he's guilty, right? That should be easy. If you can occupy Afghanistan for years, then you can surely make the effort to extradite him. But they didn't. They were clearly adamant to just go in and bomb Afghanistan and occupy it. This was a chance to avoid war, and Bush did not take it. And just 1 month after the invasion, Tony Blair claimed al-Qaeda was destroyed. All the infrastructure was gone. Okay, well, if the goal of the war on terror was to defeat al-Qaeda, then why did you stay for 20 years? This shows you that they are occupiers. Either Tony Blair was lying, or for once, he was being honest and admitting that they were staying in Afghanistan for very different reasons than just going after al-Qaeda. Because after they got rid of al-Qaeda, now all of a sudden the enemy is the Taliban. And it's not just the Taliban. Oh, they have to stay for nation building and women's rights and you name it. They find every reason under the sun to justify imperialism. And one of the real reasons that they stayed in Afghanistan, besides making money, was that they wanted a military presence at Iran and China's doorstep. Now, all of a sudden, Iran has U.S. bases to the east on its border with Afghanistan. It's got U.S. bases to the north, and then U.S. bases in the west after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Very practical, right, to have American bases on Iran's border and China's border without actually invading them, but just close enough to intimidate them. Now, if we talk about the war on terror, there's one important question to ask. How successful was this war on terror? If the goal was to defeat terrorism, well, then it was a failure, a disaster. Because ever since they started the war on terror, there have been more suicide attacks, more terrorism, and not just more in general, but there are more people dying from these terrorist attacks. And where are these people dying? In the countries where America claims it is fighting terrorism. I mean, either America is helping fuel the rise of terrorism, or it is so incompetent and dangerous that it is inadvertently causing more terrorism. And either way, the conclusion, the logical conclusion from this is that you should not be invading other people's countries. It is undeniable. The West invading other countries is not a force for good in the world. It is making the world more dangerous. Before the invasion in 2001, Al-Qaeda was supposedly just confined to Afghanistan. Well, now you apparently have Al-Qaeda in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, in sub-Saharan Africa. And now you have different flavors of Daesh. But instead of admitting this and asking the hard questions, the media is just turning around and burying its head in the sand and focusing on the withdrawal. And even during the pullout by U.S. troops, what happens? A terrorist attack. 170 people tragically killed at Kabul airport. I mean, nothing is more emblematic of what a failure this entire campaign has been. And this isn't something just confined to Afghanistan, as they went and implicated Iraq into this mess with this absurd lie about Saddam Hussein having links to Al-Qaeda, even claiming that he wanted to give Al-Qaeda nuclear weapons. So after they invaded Afghanistan under this pretext of fighting terrorism, then they invaded Iraq, even though both these countries had nothing to do with 9/11. All that was necessary was to seemingly claim a link to Al-Qaeda. That's all they had to do. And that's why the AUMF has been used in at least 19 countries to bomb 19 countries. And this hasn't just happened under Bush. This is something that has been pursued by every president. Obama massively expanded the U.S. drone strike program. Under Trump, airstrikes increased by 432%. Just this month, a drone strike ordered by President Biden killed an entire family in Afghanistan. Now you have all these people dying from terrorism, from new variants of Al-Qaeda, of Daesh, all these attacks on the rise. And those people who weren't killed by the terrorists were killed by the Americans, by the coalition of the willing, by state terrorism. And if you look at Afghanistan, 50,000 dead. And that's a conservative estimate. Pakistan, where the war spilled over to, lost masses of people because of U.S. drone strikes. And then the figure is really in the hundreds of thousands. But it doesn't end there. 1 million Iraqis dead, not to mention the millions of refugees, half of Syria's population displaced. You know, 3,000 people died on 9/11. How many 9/11s has Afghanistan had? How many 9/11s has Iraq had? How many 9/11s have Pakistan, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, Libya? How many have they had? Or are you going to come here and tell me that 3,000 Americans are worth more than millions of Arabs and Muslims? Are you telling me that it's okay to kill millions of Muslims and Arabs to avenge 3,000 Americans? Without a doubt, the real victims of the war on terror are surely those whose countries were invaded. Joining me is British political activist Chris Nynham. He is a founding member of the Stop the War Coalition, an advocacy group for peace and against interventionism. Chris was one of the organizers of the protest on 15th of February 2003, when masses of people poured into the streets voicing their opposition against the invasion of Iraq. It has been claimed as the largest public demonstration in British history. He also served under former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. So Chris, you know, it's the 20th anniversary. We're 20 years on now from 9/11. We've had the war on terror, so much conflict. Could I just get your thoughts very briefly on this 20th anniversary of this terrible attack and everything that's happened since then?
I think both the attack itself, which was a tragedy, and the response from the West have been absolutely catastrophic. I mean, the world has changed in the last 20 years very, very profoundly. And that's mainly because the kind of response to 9/11 that was charted by the US administration under Bush has been catastrophically bad. The whole idea of invading a country in order to liberate it, to change it, to bring progress, is a completely faulty one. It's been, in terms of particularly Western foreign policy, it's been an absolutely catastrophic 20 years.
One of the things that I remember from when I was a kid, and this has always stayed in my memory, is the February 15th protest, you know, seeing millions of people from around the world, as you just mentioned, and especially in the UK, flooding the streets. If I'm not mistaken, you helped organize this protest, right? And so I wanted to ask you, I mean, what does it take to sustain a movement like that, to keep a sentiment of anti-war, anti-imperialism going in the public? And how important is it to have public opinion against the wars in the first place?
there were a number of different elements to building the movement. First of all, it was trying to establish the broadest possible kind of coalition of forces, which meant getting, obviously, people from the left, campaigning hard to get the unions on board, which is something we managed to do, some of the trade, most of the trade unions in Britain, starting with the more militant unions, but gradually kind of pushing outwards from that base. Crucially, the Muslim communities in Britain, we approached, sometimes they approached us. We worked very, very closely together with them, and that was very important in terms of even the first demonstration in November, November 2001, there was a large number of people from, you know, the Muslim community in Britain on the demonstration, which was a very, very powerful statement. I think it had a big effect on people.
You recently wrote an article, I think, in the Morning Star about the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. And you mentioned that, quote, supporters of the invasion claim that there were advances in the country under occupation, but that the facts suggest otherwise. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, I mean, the two things that are commonly said by defenders of the war, apologists for the war in Afghanistan, are that there was a health service that was built up that was, you know, a massive improvement, and B, that women's lives have improved. And I think really, fundamentally, neither thing is true. I mean, Afghanistan spends 0.6% of its GDP on health, which is one of the lowest percentages anywhere in the world, and stands against an average in South Asia of 5%. So, I mean, health provision is absolutely diabolical in the country. That's the truth. And secondly, on the issue of advances for women, I think there were some advances for women in more middle class or elite circles in the cities, but in general, life for women in Afghanistan has been as bad, if not worse, as it has for everyone else. I mean, 240,000 people have been killed by the war, to start with, but also the devastation of the infrastructure, the general violence and lawlessness in the country. All of these things have impacted massively on women's lives. And actually, if you look at the stats, the levels of literacy for women in Afghanistan are the worst anywhere in the world. Only 18% of women of women in Afghanistan are literate at this point, after this so-called progress. So I think, unfortunately, this is war propaganda. It was used at the time of the launch of the war, and it's now being used to desperately try and justify the unjustifiable. And to try and pretend that what has happened in Afghanistan was anything other than an absolute disaster. So, you know, I don't think we should allow the people who support the war to get away with this kind of nonsense. They also talk about economic progress. Look at the World Bank statistics. Look at the UN statistics. There has been no economic progress in Afghanistan in the last 20 years. In fact, most indexes suggest that it's gone backwards, which is not surprising, because that's what happens when you bombard a country with a huge amount of munitions and send troops rampaging through the streets of towns and cities. You know, this isn't a particularly sensible economic strategy.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
But even the average American, they've also lost in this war, not only because the politicians use them like cannon fodder, sending them off to die or get their legs blown off in exchange for some medal. On average, there are 22 veterans committing suicide every day. Something clearly wrong going on here. And the irony in all of this is that Americans who thought they were delivering democracy and freedom to others lost their own freedom and democracy. Under their very noses, U.S. politicians were passing things like the Patriot Act, warrantless wiretapping, or the president's surveillance program, signed barely 24 hours after 9/11 by then Vice President Dick Cheney. They started a mass surveillance program to spy on you in the name of fighting terrorism. And it doesn't stop there. Just look at Guantanamo Bay. One of the most horrific consequences of the war on terror is, without a doubt, Guantanamo Bay. The Bush administration set up this prison on occupied Cuban territory and has used it to kidnap Muslim men from around the world, bring them there, and hold them without charge or trial. One of the men who was taken to Guantanamo Bay is Mansour al-Daifi from Yemen. He was never charged with any crime, never mind convicted of a crime. An innocent man, he was kept in Guantanamo Bay for 14 years and only freed recently in 2016. Now he is an activist and a CAGE Guantanamo Project coordinator. He's also just released a book titled Don't Forget Us Here, detailing his time in Guantanamo. Hello, Mansour. Thank you so much for coming on the program. Mansour, for those who are not familiar with your story, with what you had to endure, could you tell us who you are, what you did before you were detained and taken to Guantanamo Bay, and how you ended up being there?
I am Mansour Daifi. Now I am holding also number 441, because also this is my number. I think I own it. I pay 15 years for it. I am from Yemen, where I was, as you know, like I lived for around 18 years. I grew up in was raised in a very conservative family. I finished my high school in Yemen. Then I went to Afghanistan for research mission. Only after a few months, I was ambushed by warlord, sold to the CIA for bounty money, imprisoned in the black site, then shipped to Guantanamo.
So a warlord just wanted some money from the CIA?
As you know, when America invaded Afghanistan in 2001, they were throwing flyers offering large bounty of money for anyone who hand over foreigners or Afghanis. So according to the ACLU, that 86% of the 20s at Guantanamo were either mistaken identity or sold for bounty. People think that people at Guantanamo, they were captured in the battlefield. No, that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case. Now only the research proved that only 8% who has ties to Al-Qaeda or Taliban.
Right. So that's out of several hundred. Right.
Out of 800, I mean, United States wanted to send a message to the world. They can go beyond any laws. They won't abide by any law or agreements. So they created Guantanamo outside of the law, baseless legal place. Also, at the same time, Guantanamo is a military prison within a military base. It's like a black hole. So they said federal law doesn't apply in Guantanamo. Kobe law doesn't apply. Geneva Convention doesn't apply. So it's outside of the law. So they can do whatever they want. There is no accountability for what happened there. The youngest detainee was only a few months old. The oldest was 105 years old. To that extent,
what's the one common denominator between everyone who's detained there? You're just Muslim.
Yeah, I mean, yes, like all of us were Muslims. Like, as I told you, 50 nationalities, 20 years spoken, all of us were Muslims. At that time, General Jeffrey Miller arrived, and he started developing what they called enhanced interrogation technique or enhanced torture technique.
Torture.
So they started, like, applying sleep deprivation, beating, loud music, raping, sexual assault, solitary confinement, all kind of methods. Because they used to take the Holy Quran, put it under feet, pee on it, throw what? It on the ground. Yeah, the interrogators, yes. Stopping us from praying, miking us. I remember when I used to pray, they would throw us the Israeli flag or the American flag. Sometime there was, like, we call it the satanic room, where they have a room, and dark room, where they put candles, and the floor is like stars and signs.
What?
It is crazy. I told you, Guantanamo was an experimenting lab. So let us finish the story. When James Yee tried to protest the torture in the detention, himself, was accused of espionage, was accused of sympathy with detainees. He was detained. He was detained, arrested, and detained, and interrogated. He was put in the orange jumpsuit and shackles and hooded and a fly back to the United States. This is American Muslim, not getting anyone. Captain in the America, in the American Army. To the extent, imagine if they have done this with their own soldier, the one who came to serve his own country. What about us? They view us the worst of the worst, terrorists. They view us as like who people who are responsible for 9/11. So when General Miller arrived in 2003, when they found out the majority of the detainees, they have no ties with the Al-Qaeda. I mean, even Dan Rumsfeld, he said most of the detainees at Guantanamo there are dirt farmers, totally disconnected from the world. When we arrived there, I mean, we had no clue where we were or what's going to happen to us. We asked interrogators what I have done. And they couldn't answer us.
This is what I wanted to ask you. Did any of the guards or staff, you know, or the people who are holding you captive, did they show mercy at any moment? And what happened as a result of that, if they did?
You know, Richard, you'll be surprised. When they, before they brought the guards to Guantanamo, the soldiers, they used to take them to New York with the, to the, where the Twin Towers collapsed.
Ground Zero, yeah.
To, and tell them that the people who are responsible for that are being detained at Guantanamo. Imagine those guards saw what happened on when they came to Guantanamo, they feel of hate and grudge. But those guards would live for us at least for 6 months or 1 year. So you cannot fool them all the time. You know, in the military, they try to program their mind to control them, to feed them with hate. And some of them honestly came to apologize to us. Some of them actually convert to Islam. Last night we had an event, one of the two former Guantanamo guards, both of them convert to Islam, alhamdulillah. And the other many stories. There were also doctors, there were nurses, there were some kind of staff who sympathized with that. They understood. But again, they're in the military.
Given everything that you've just told me, everything you went through in Guantanamo Bay, everything that's happened in the last 20 years, what do you have to say about the United States war on terror or war of terror?
Of course, it was a tragedy, and there were like innocent killed there. But what about the victims? Almost like around 1 million Muslim killed around the world. Almost like over 35 million displaced, and hundreds of thousands tortured, abused, and imprisoned. So, also those victims. So United States, actually, after 9/11, they produced their own 9/11 in every country. And I don't think those victims or families of 9/11 would agree to that policy. I don't think punishing the wrong people for what happened, I don't agree with that. Because, you know, vengeance in the wrong places, I don't think they would allow even the misuse of that tragedy to go to that extent. But what we have seen, as you know, it just, who benefit from that war on terror? Agencies, countries, individuals.
Mansour Al-Daifi, thank you so much for your time. Really, I'm so grateful. Stories like Mansour's are the important ones. They're the ones America doesn't want the world to hear, and indeed, the most heartbreaking one. And not a single U.S. official has ever been prosecuted for any of these wars and war crimes in the last 20th century. What was this all for? The U.S. even spent 20 years saying it's fighting the Taliban. The Taliban are right back in power now, almost 20 years to the day. And in their interim government, we even find Guantanamo Bay ex-detainees. One minister even has a bounty on his head. All this time, the West has been saying it's fighting terrorism and killing terrorists, but they've actually just been killing civilians. The real terrorists were never caught or prosecuted or killed. The real terrorists were in Washington, D.C., the terrorists were in Whitehall planning the wars. 20 years, and what did they accomplish? What did this war on terror accomplish? So many people dead, so many people wounded, so many refugees. Who mourns for those victims? I ask you, where is the mourning and the grieving process for them? 9/11 was used as a pretext by corrupt politicians and corporatists to expand their empire and their profit. So yes, absolutely, mourn the 3,000 Americans, but mourn the others too, those that were killed and forgotten, those that are being killed right now, that are maimed right now, that are living under military occupation right now. the Arab and Muslim world has not even begun to recover from the fallout of 9/11 and America's response. This tragedy on 9/11 has been exploited to carry out some of the worst atrocities and war crimes and acts of terrorism, because invading others and killing them, that's terrorism. That is true terrorism. And that's what we've been living through, that's what we've been seeing, and it's still going to continue if people don't wake up and see the truth, that the war on terror has always been the war of terror. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight. The latest data from the UK Office for National Statistics shows that coronavirus in England is now largely an infection among young adults, with cases in the 16 to 24-year-old age range 6 times more common than in the 50 to 69-year-old age range. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Haroon Siddiqui and Heather Stewart. The piece is titled UK Doctors Warn Over Increasing Number of Young People with COVID in ICU. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian.